So, welcome to the 3 R's, Reform, Revolution, Resistance, the Problematic Forms of Anti-Capitalism, and it's hosted by Platypus Boston. My name is Laura. I'm East Coast Regional Coordinator for Platypus, and I'm a graduate student in History of Science and Technology at Harvard. I want to thank all of our panelists very, very much for participating, and thank you for being here today. And before I speak to tonight's panel, I have some words. I'm going to introduce our panelists, they're going to follow a kind of strange, out-of-order pattern here. So to my immediate right is Gage. Gage is a communist and member of the IWW and the Boston Local of Common Struggle Libertarian Communist Federation. They have been involved in organizing for over a decade and a half, with strong influences being the communization current, autonomism, materialist feminism, autonomous feminism, and ecofeminism. They are a former organizer of Camp Trans and Transfix NorCal. Most recently, they helped organize for the Oakland General Strike with Occupy Oakland and the IWW. They have been a street medic for several years, are a lay herbalist, a health educator, and a nursing student. Followed by Gage will be Jeff. Jeff is to my far right. Jeff is a longtime member of the Socialist Alternative and a union activist, currently in the Executive Committee and National Committee of Socialist Alternative. He's a member of the Harvard Union of Clerical and Technical Workers. Previously, Jeff has served as the secretary of the Massachusetts chapter of the Labor Party in the 90s. In the 80s, he was executive board member of UE Local 262 in Boston, and before that, a member of the Bakery Workers Union in factories in upstate New York. Joseph Ramsey, to my left, is a writer, educator, and activist working on many fronts in the Boston area. He is editor of Cultural Logic, an electronic journal of Marxist theory and practice, a participant in the Kasama Project, as well as a member of the editorial board of the journal Socialism and Democracy. Joe has been deeply involved in the Occupy movement since its emergence, in particular helping organize the Howard Zinn Memorial Lecture Series, writing and helping to edit and distribute the Boston Occupier newspaper, and helping to build the ongoing Occupy MBTA campaign to defend public transportation from austerity and privatization. And Philip Thompson, to my far left, is an urban planner and a political scientist, and he is an associate professor of urban politics at MIT. He is frequent advisor to trade unions in their effort to work with immigrant community groups across the United States. Phil has worked as Deputy General Manager of the New York Housing Authority and as Director of the Mayor's Office of Housing Coordination. So I'd like to introduce Platypus and the event. So I have an introductory, some words here before we get started. Platypus formed out of a shared sense of discontent with the anti-Iraq war movement as it winded down in Chicago 2006 to 2007. These frustrations generated questions. What were the stakes of that movement, the kinds of ideas, such as imperialism, that it espoused, and what kind of society might it possibly have had in mind? We sense that the anti-war movement said more about the pervasive lack of engagement with these questions, however central they had been to the leftist practice since the 18th century. We started to examine the concept of the left, to use Leszek Kulikowski's phrase, in an attempt to look back on a century of leftist politics. The new left of the 60s and 70s, before that, the old left of the 30s, and leftist politics today. Our experience leads us to say provocatively that the left is dead. The crucial questions about trying to make free society have been unceremoniously ceded to the right, which has plenty of visions for society. We find that in this present moment, though, there's no shortage of demanding or promising change. Yet the prospects of social transformation remain ambiguous. The role of the left in this transformation is still wholly unclear, and this is why Platypus convenes discussions, or like this one, organizes reading group, coffee breaks, and publishes an open submission newspaper dedicated to showcasing the fragments of political impulses that remain. You can find 2 issues of that newspaper in the back. We have chapters at schools in Chicago, New York City, Toronto, London, Berlin, and burgeoning chapters in Delhi and Thessaloniki, Greece, and other places, all comprised of largely young people actively learning about the left's present and past. In Boston, Platypus organizes 2 chapters, one at Harvard, one at Mass Art currently. And if you're interested in these problems, there's a sign-up sheet in addition to the newspapers in the back, in that circular table over there. So the discussion today is actually a reprisal of a forum that Platypus organized not long after it became a group, a year before Obama's election, in the financial crisis. Besides sharing the same title, the forum shares something we are trying to make sense of today, a post-Cold War, distinctly 90s, or aughts, zeros, global ultra-capitalist politics, which encompasses a broad variety of forms of protest against the world capitalist order and individuals' roles therein. The line of questioning that Platypus is trying to provoke concerns the stakes of our and this political imagination and moment. What concepts do we use to conceive of a transformation of society, and why? We challenge our panelists to think about the categories of reform, resistance, and revolution, not as opposing tactical camps, or even simply as steps in the process, but as places to start thinking about the concept of the left and its relationship to society. Forms of labor and politics of it, politics of labor, look different today than 40 years ago. If in 2007 we wanted to begin to understand responses to this with our first forum, Reform, Resistance, Revolution, from autonomism to the precarious class and anarchist left and postmodern and post-Marxist turn in academic left, today we speak as the Occupy movement grapples with forms of decision-making leadership and to define what it fights for or against. A common liberal complaint about Occupy is its lack of demands, which is presumably parallel to a diversity of tactics. David Graeber, in our interview published in the Platypus Review, copies of which are in the back, pointed out that Occupy Wall Street did not intend to take control of the instruments of power. Rather, its goal was to highlight a certain notion of direct democracy. What are we to make of this exercise? And wouldn't it be ironic, although not surprising, if the experiment in direct democracy, if Graeber is thinking along the right lines, was used to garner support for the Democrats in the upcoming election? Wouldn't this fall below the threshold of a reformative resolution to Occupy? So the dissolving of meaning of reform or social change is suggested by another moment in the 3 Rs, which haunts the present discussion. That's Rosa Luxemburg's pamphlet from the first decade of the 20th century, titled Reform or Revolution. And this, of course, is something we had in mind in the beginning of our first forum. Luxemburg argued that social reforms could not be counterposed to social revolution, but that the subordination of revolutionary aims to reformism signified a new loss of nerve for Second International Marxism in German social democracy. Indeed, the view that reform and revolution mandate a strict dichotomy narrowed the scope of emancipatory politics. And this view was propagated not by bureaucrats, but by Luxembourg's colleagues and comrades on the left. So finally, we have used the same epigraph that you might have read in the promotional material today, in which social theorist Moish Verstone suggests that the defeat of the new left in the 60s and early 70s placed the left in such a state of despair, what he calls helplessness, that it looked back to the world of the 60s and echoed its destruction, like an angel of death. He says, the idea of fundamental transformation became bracketed and was replaced by a more ambiguous notion of resistance. Why is this a problem for Postone? If this sounds like a loaded question, or if it seems Platypus has an answer, or thinks it does, I want to complicate this view. A reprisal of a question concerning the current forms of anti-capitalism gains salience precisely because old problems continue to escape our sustained attention. We know that the resolution of the Cold War, which impresses upon the entirety of the 90s, resulted in the disorientation of the left. It is no coincidence that the politics of our age, my generation, is collectively one of ambiguous resistance to the system. With a renewed interest in the Black Bloc, prompted by Occupy, there is increasing attention to those forms of politics which arose in the 70s, such as notions of horizontality, and emerging from critiques of experiences within the Communist Party and Marxism. But Platypus treats Postone's words and the whole predicament as a challenge, that is, an avenue for practical inquiry, not a thesis to follow or discard. That's why we are trying anew to have this conversation. So in this spirit, our panelists have been asked to speak for 12 to 15 minutes. We have asked them some questions, a copy of which is on the table back there as well. We'll follow it with a round of responses, 5 to 8 minutes each, and we will then eagerly open it up to question and answers from the audience. So, Gage, please.
Hi, so thank you for the introduction and setting this up. My name's Gage. I'm from Common Struggle Libertarian Communist Federation, and when we were asked to speak on this panel, the rest of the Boston local asked if I would speak. I want to note, though, obviously I haven't run everything I'm going to say past my group, but I feel the things I'm going to say are going to be within the general agreement of the group. I think that one of the differences in our group is that I think most of the other members of the group are much more influenced by anarchism than I am. I don't feel like there's a conflict between a firm border or a conflict between Marxism and anarchism, because I think they're two fundamentally different things. For my comrades, when they talk about anarchism, it sounds like a set of principles. To me, Marxism, after Karl Korsch, is a method of analyzing the conflicts in the world. So you use that method. It's a method to give you tools for revolutionary struggle. So I wanted to start that off. So if people are more interested in Common Struggle, we have our literature table over there. Our website is commonstruggleallonework.org. And I would encourage people to check us out. So with that out of the way, I define resistance as any effort made to prevent something else from occurring. And I know that on the surface this doesn't sound particularly insightful. It sounds like it's overly broad, but I think that defining it that way is going to lead us somewhere where it's going to be useful for us. So here's an example of resistance. I have a 13-month-old niece who I take care of frequently. I love her to death. She's adorable, but she does not like wearing shoes. It is really hard to get shoes on a toddler, if any of you have watched a toddler. In a way, can we say she's resisting my efforts to put shoes on her? Yes. I think the point I'm getting here is that resistance doesn't always have political content, or political content we'd like, and resistance occurs in a lot of ways. Some things are meaningful in certain circumstances and others. So I think we need to really go beyond the surface of resistance and look at what the content is there. So I think that if we want to go back to the anti-globalization movement, there was a lot of resistance. It, I think, in a way, deteriorated into summit hopping, where people's goal was to, like, can we replicate Seattle of 99 and shut down this summit? And that became the goal. And obviously, people did have ideas for what they wanted the world to look like, but they didn't really, there wasn't an emphasis on all this emphasis of creating this infrastructure of summit hopping. There wasn't really an emphasis on pushing for anything beyond shutting down summits. In an organized fashion. So, and obviously there wasn't, I don't think, the necessary analysis by a lot of people, because obviously globalization started long before 1999. So I think, you know, those are important struggles. I think it influenced a generation of pro-revolutionaries, either who summit hopped or people like me who didn't summit hop, who were around that age where, you know, this is what we were seeing as when we were younger radicals and everything. So, but in another way, it's kind of a dead end, because when your focus is on let's shut down a summit, that's not sufficient. And I think, you know, we can all think of resistance work that is too. The far right was mentioned in the introduction, and I think we're seeing, obviously, a rise in resistance from the far right that we want to oppose. So, and I think another thing we need to oppose is certain forms of reformism. Co-option by the Democratic Party was mentioned, but I think I want to generally look at this as a top-down reformism, where there's a hijacking of the autonomous movements of the working class. Like, what do people, out of the conditions of their own lives, when they organize themselves, what are they struggling for? And I think there's also a tendency for bureaucrats, whether it's the Democratic Party or, you know, the bureaucrats in a trade union who are the ones sitting making the deals and trying to get people back to work rather than the rank and file. I think there is a tendency for those people to try to take that resistance and put it in channel into a direction they can control and can lead to their vision rather than the vision of the people who are engaging in that resistance. So I think that's another thing we need to be wary of. One thing that struck me lately that I've heard about, speaking of co-option of Occupy, is there's a thing called the 99% Spring. It's very blatant that it's, you know, move on, it's the left of the Democratic Party, and they're talking about doing a lot of non-violent direct action trainings to get the vote out for Obama. Like, this is an attempt, this is going on. I think we're seeing a new type of reformism in the sense of, in a narrow sense of reformism, is stuff that seeks to maintain the current system by doing a few tweaks and adjustments, and I think that's something as pro-revolutionaries we should be opposed to. I think we're seeing, I know myself and a few comrades have thrown the term around for this as militant reformism. Take as people get more used to tactics beyond, and the general populace gets more used to tactics beyond writing a petition, signing a petition, or writing letters, or maybe just standing out there with a sign, as they get to, you know, oh, we're going to all sit down and lock arms in front of a bank door. Okay, let's use those tactics now they're used to them, but let's use them for top-down ends. So I think that's important. So I think I've made an explicit distinction here between top and bottom, top-down and bottom-up. And I want to make another I want to kind of challenge this explicit distinction between everyday life and the, you know, control of society or the overarching societal politics. One thing I think, you know, we learn from second wave feminism is that personal is political, and that's not because we're all special snowflakes. It's because the mode of production, the system we live under, is an emergent property of the total of all the social relations in all our lives. This doesn't mean lifestyleism is any good. It doesn't change anything. But I think the roots of revolutionary struggle is always going to be in people's day-to-day lives, in the day-to-day lives of the excluded and the exploited. Their ability to get together and say, myself and all my coworkers, wait a second, we all barely can keep a roof over our heads, but someone's getting rich off our work. That's a commonality. Everybody has that experience, and they can come together on it. So, and obviously there's a lot more. There's, you know, all the times when we raise children, we're told that that's not work. But, you know, it certainly feels like work a lot of the time. So I think that we need to not indulge in lifestyle, but we need to realize that the potential for struggle is always in our everyday lives, and by looking up our everyday lives. So I think there has been a shift in how we see that, but I think that's always been there. Because obviously it's always been everybody's everyday lives. So, and I think that, you know, how these things structure our everyday lives, society, because obviously society comes out of our everyday lives, society then structures our everyday lives, it's a two-way street. On the macro, you know, can't tell what an individual's person's experiences are by looking at them, but on a macro scale, what we can see is that they're very strongly determined by the sort of things that structure the working class, and the things that the working class is composed of are race and gender and sexuality, and those things very strongly, I think, affect the experiences of when you look at people as groups, as members of subgroups of the working class. So, and I think we can identify those common experiences, not just a vulgar workerism where it's only people on wage labor, but we can look at all those experiences, we can identify commonalities, and people in those experiences can reach out, struggle together, build self-organization, and I think that can win us reforms that, instead of disempowering us, empower us, because we win them ourselves. And I think it can also, when we have opportunities, and I think crises of capital are opportunities. They horrifically affect people's lives, but they're also opportunities, because this is a point where, you know, capital is weak. And that if we have, you know, significant self-organization, we have the experience of these day-to-day struggles, and, you know, we have, you know, the drive to link up these day-to-day struggles, we have a chance to, you know, create some sort of rupture where revolution can occur. But I think, you know, we can't, you know, just be revolutionary all the time. I don't think, you know, you can go out and say, I'm going to be revolutionary right now, because there's not the opportunity for it. And I think, you know, there are things we need to avoid when we have those movements. I think one of the things that, you know, Occupy has kind of been a mixed bag is, yes, there's been an emphasis on everybody participating in decision-making. Oftentimes those decision-making processes have not been good. There's that fetishization of consensus, which I think, you know, anybody who's been around radical communities for any length of time, kind of you hear the word consensus and you want to run screaming sometimes, just because you've sat through way too many 4-hour-long meetings to make some simple decision, because, you know, there's a couple people who clearly are not going to convince everybody else, but everybody has to agree. So I think that's problematic. But there is this emphasis on we're not representatives of other people, we're struggling for ourselves, and I think that's important. So, as always, there's contradictions. So, and I think this conception of crisis, autonomous working class power, and rejection of mediation and representation is a lot more popular now than it was 25 years ago. I think it's, and I think we need to look, well, you know, look at the whole scope of history, but particularly look at the last 40 years. We have the death of Keynesianism, we have the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact, the beginning of austerity, neoliberalism, a new phase of globalization. All of these things, I think, really change the terrain of struggle, and certain things become clearer to people and certain things become more obscure because you're looking at a different world. I'm not a fan of picking one arbitrary date and say, on this day, everything changed. A lot of people like to say, oh, after May of 68, everything changed, or after 1917, everything changed, or wherever. I think things do change, and you know, I think things are a lot different now than they were 100 years ago. But I don't think we can ever go and say, after this day, everything was different. But I think we need to still learn from that history, even though we need to not say, you know, what might have been true in 1917 is not necessarily true now. And so I think this new phase of globalization, and I think this changes our struggle and train a lot, this is something I like to put forward, is taking after Antonio Negri, that I think capitalist completely sprung loose from national borders. We are in a different era. It's not that we have a unipolar system. There is no real pole because capital is everywhere now. We can't really say that there are nations that or peoples who are outside of capital or pre-capitalist mode of production. Things have changed. Any battle to stop globalization is long ago been lost. So I think that makes different things clearer, and that makes different things less clear. I think of things that I'm worried about in how we struggle. I'm worried that people may perceive themselves as too fragmented, too many identities have been created, and that people might feel like they have no real way to challenge capital because they feel like I'm only able to act as part of this tiny group, not as a larger whole. So I think that's a danger. I think we can be so fragmented that we can be rendered powerless. And I think that's a barrier to overcome because clearly there are still generalities that are true about the world. The fact that, you know, there is a system of exploitation. There is a system of domination because there isn't domination without exploitation, exploitation without domination. Somebody can't force you to, you know, sell them your labor unless you're denied the ability to take things for yourself. And people can't, you know, dominate you nearly as easily if, you know, you can just ignore them and go about your life. So I think those are linked. But so I think, though, these changes where we don't have a bipolar world in the same sense anymore is that I think we're less likely to think about the process of revolution in a mechanistic manner. I think that this idea of first we do this, then we do this, and we implement this, I think that idea is kind of dead. I think we all need to, I think we all kind of feel like there's not, you know, a step-by-step process of revolution anymore, that we can just look at the checklist and like, okay, we're on step three now, 20 more steps to go, and we have full communism. So I think that, and we also don't think we're likely to see revolution in vulgarly economic terms. We have seen repeatedly, I think, when we look at the struggles of various groups in the working class, like when we look at the struggles of women and we look at other struggles, the struggles over sexuality, we can look at the history of the communist parties and see, you know, their view of women's liberation was to force women into the workplace and not ever talking about what was work in the home. There were communist parties that for decades were thought of homosexuality as a bourgeois deviation. I think the days that anybody could seriously think those things, I think, are long gone. So I think we can lay that to rest. I think there's a lot, we have the opportunity right now to lay a lot of our old baggage to rest and study it as history rather than have to bring it back to a place that we are actively tackling with it. Because we obviously don't want to forget our history. Anyway, so I feel like I've addressed a few of the questions, and I want to close on a more positive note because I'm kind of, you know, questioning exactly how we go about this process of revolution beyond, you know, building some power and encouraging self-organization and autonomy. I want to quote, I think this is probably one of my things that are the most favorite things I've seen written by any living author. This is one, a quote from Antonio Negri, in which he wrote in A Worker's Party Against Work. Perhaps for the first time, outside of utopia or in those formidable moments of enthusiasm which are insurrections, the objective that the class proposes in its intensity, in its totality, includes the needs of individuals. Liberation cannot be left until communism. The new needs introduced by the most recent generations of the working class are needs of liberation. Nothing is richer or finer than to be able to connect the immediate needs of individuals to the political needs of the class. I want to kind of, you know, maybe, I think this is what he meant, but I don't think we can have full liberation until communism. I don't think it's possible to be completely liberated in a non-communist society. But I want to say that the process of achieving liberation and the process of achieving communism are one and the same. I think every step that we take ourselves as part of groups within the class struggling and as a class as a whole struggling to achieve our liberation is also the steps we take systemically. So I wanted to close my opening remarks with that.
Well, thanks for inviting Socialist Alternative. As Laura said, my name is Jeff Booth. I have a comrade, Ryan, here as well. If anyone wants to talk to us afterwards, whatever, please do. There's not much time here. And also, because there's not much time, some other ways to find out something about what we're doing and what we think as an organization. Check out our paper, Justice. We have some copies over there. We have a radio show every Sunday on WMFO 91.5 FM. That's the Tufts College Station. It's called Socialist Alternative Radio. It's 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. By the way, if anyone here wants to come on the radio, there's the show. You don't have to be in political agreement with us or anything. We'd like to interview people on the left. By left, we just define that as basically being anti-capitalist and not in the Democratic Party. So you're all welcome, I would guess. We also have, of course, website, socialistalternative.org. And also, I'm not just here representing Socialist Alternative. Socialist Alternative is in political solidarity with a group called the Committee for Workers International. And that's an international socialist organization in over 40 countries of parties or parties in formation or small organizations, all of the above. And internationalism is a huge thing for us, and I hope I can work that into the discussion in a clear way tonight. Also, and for the CWI, just check out socialistworld.org if you want more information, or just Google Committee for Workers International. And one point about that, Committee for Workers International, it's in formation, committee. You know, that's we're not saying we're the fifth international or whatever the number is up to now. We are just trying to build and have built so far a coherent, democratic international. Obviously the working class, as Gage started into, has to fight globalization, and there's no way to do that other than having as strong international organizations as possible. It's unions and left groups. And we do have a coherent structure, we do have a democratic structure, and I'm just pointing that out because I think it's somewhat unique and it's something I think we all are striving for one way or another. Now, I was very happy to be, we were very happy to be invited to this, and the overarching thing I want to try to get out is that if you read the quote here by Moishe Postone, or if you look at the questions, I think Marxism, and again, Gage pointed this out, I thought, well, Marxism is a method, and I think Marxism gives, dialectical materialism and flowing for that historical and economic materialism. I think we can find out where Moishe is coming from here, where these questions are coming from, and sort of pinpoint them a little bit historically. And we put that methodology, use that methodology to analyze our own view of the world as individuals and as individuals in left organizations. So what are some common things we have in common here in this room, most of us? Well, a big, huge thing that affects all of our consciousness is none of us here, almost none of us here, have lived through a true mass movement. The anti-war movement in the mid-2000s, like where I guess Platypus was born, came close, but I would argue did not reach that critical mass in this country. You could argue the Occupy movement is a mass movement. I would say it approached it. It might still reach it. We're very supportive of the Occupy movement, but truly, it's not a mass movement. And we can get into the reasons for that in question and answer period, if people are interested in that. So not having been in a mass movement and having that impact our consciousness affects tremendously our view of the possibilities of revolution. That's an extremely important thing to keep in mind. And I learned that. I had to learn that, you know. And I learned it in two ways. I learned it because I was able to draw from the international experience of comrades in the Committee for Workers International, who did actually help organize and or participate in mass movements. So, for example, one of the first people I discussed joining what was then called Nothing in this Country, yes, one of the founding members were just a handful of people in the early 80s, was an organizer from Ireland who had helped organize the Derry Uprising and said basically, well, you know, we spent years putting up posters in the city center and had five people show up to our meetings. When the Derry Uprising was happening, we put up one poster and had 1,000 people show up to our meetings. And he was able to explain to me what a mass movement was like. We had a comrade from Nigeria come and speak to the second biggest section of the Committee for Works International in Nigeria. We have had comrades that have led mass movements. They came and spoke here in the past, and were able to try to get us to at least approximate in our consciousness what that was like, that the years of struggle, the years of getting stuck in to a worker's struggle, all of a sudden pay off. In times that we can't predict, and we can't predict how long it's going to last, we have those moments, those revolutionary movements, and that's what capitalism generates continuously. And again, Marxism is the methodology for understanding this. Capitalism obviously generates the terrible inequality, terrible poverty, terrible goading of the working class. I mean, let's face it, working class people, myself included, we take the path of least resistance as a class. We will do, you know, especially if you have a family. I have a family, you know. You take the path of least resistance to survive. But the paths are being blocked more and more. If you use a rough metaphor, I was thinking about this. I mentioned it to Ryan. I probably shouldn't say it. Ryan just lost his job, okay? I can't tell you how many people I know that just lost their jobs. My job, I work at Harvard. I want to talk to when I talked to Laura afterwards, my job is under threat. I worked there 25 years. All of a sudden, they tore up my job description, told me to reapply for a job, and I might get fired this month. I might get laid off this month, right? So I see the working class as a whole as this bear. I know it's kind of an ugly and brings up Stalinist connotations. I'm sorry. But this bear that's just being goaded. We're being poked and prodded, and we're blindly reaching out like a bear would, waking up from hibernation. But you know, at a certain point, we're gonna fixate. We're gonna see who's, and we're gonna go forward. And that kind of revolutionary optimism goes back to that original point. I haven't lived through a mass movement, and I have a hard time believing that metaphor at a certain level. But the reality is, other comrades of mine have struggled through it, and I've read about it. You know, I spent a lot of time as part of my organization looking at 1934. A seminal year, or a seminal, that's the wrong use of that word, I should never use that word, I don't understand it. 1934, an extremely important year in labor history in the United States, but not just labor history, but revolutionary history. Every big strike, every general strike in 1934, there were three of them, were led by the one in San Francisco, led by communists, the one in Ohio, led by socialists, the one in Minneapolis, led by Trotskyists, by socialists. So, you know, there's times that we can study and try to imagine what a mass movement is like and what that can do to consciousness. And there are times, and there are comrades, there are people we can talk to, activists we can talk to from other countries, places where they've had huge general strikes, places where they've, even recently, very recently. I mean, look what's happened just this year. We've got the Arab Spring, the Arab uprisings. You know, I mean, just if you can get 15 minutes with someone from Tunisia that's been involved with that, it could just blow your mind open, you know? We've had Wisconsin. We have a new pamphlet. This is I'm plugging here, but whatever. We have this pamphlet that a participant in Socialist Alternative in a grad student's union there wrote this pamphlet. I mean, the comrades that were out in Madison, it opened up huge possibilities. I'm talking young comrades, you know, very young comrades. It opened up huge possibilities in their consciousness. And the Occupy movement, of course. I mean, we all have stories, I'm sure, of either personally or people we know that Occupy has just opened up a new world for them, you know? What am I leaving out here? What else happened this year? There's something else that was in my head, and I can't remember what it was. But the point is also, and Moshe is speaking to this, I think, in this quote, the comrades, the activists that lived through the last mass movement in this country in the late 60s, early 70s, they had that elation. They saw the possibilities. They probably saw the international links, France 68, you know, Mexico City, et cetera, et cetera. They crashed and burned. They're very disappointed. They're very pessimistic, a lot of them. So we have to look at that and say, what happened? In a thumbnail sketch, we have to understand that movement was in the United States, not everywhere. France 68, not the case, but anyway. In the United States, that movement, late 60s, early 70s, was dominated by the upper middle class. It wasn't purely populated by the upper middle class. It wasn't, you know, only every last struggle wasn't some sort of, I'm not trying to say it was some sort of like class sellout or something. I'm just saying that overall, including left groups that grew tremendously in the United States at that time, there was a huge upper middle class element there. And there was an escape valve for a lot of the leaders. The big chill and all that was no accident. It was just returning to their class roots for a lot of people. And that became, that's the last mass movement we've had in this country. It was a very problematic one. So we have to try to imagine a mass movement. And I would argue, getting to the exact questions here, as I try to finish up, that resistance is an integral part of a mass movement. Because try to think of the worst times that you've experienced in your own activist life, and I'm assuming everyone here is an activist of one sort. Well, I think of the first Gulf War. You know how the anti-war movement died suddenly in around 2005 here, in the latest, during the Iraq War? That happened before. That happened in the first Gulf War. There was a certain point where, and I forget what the turning point was, I think it was U.S. troops on the ground or something, I wish I remembered more clearly, where all of a sudden we went from shutting down Starro Drive with 5,000 people to about 100 people, if that, I'd say more like 50 people in Government Center, which were all lefties in all the groups, and a lot of plainclothes cops circulating around and buying our paper. You know, that's, you know, that was a low point. 9-1-1, okay? Right after 9-1-1, I remember driving around with a friend of mine trying to find houses without American flags in front of them and just stopping, like, yay, you know? It was incredible. Now, my friend was from Haiti. Her family had suffered through the Duvalier regime. She thought that was, as far as, you know, backwardness and repression goes, that was nothing, the fact that there was this upsurge of jingoism in the United States. But for a while, using that term resistance, it cropped up a lot. I heard, you know, I think one of the sections of the Committee for Works International up in Canada was considering changing its name to Socialist Resistance. At the time, it sounded like it made sense. What I'm getting at is resistance, as far as I would understand it, is it's an integral part of revolutionary struggle, because it's that point of revolutionary struggle, the lowest point. It's where you see an enemy that you might not be able to beat no matter what. And you're really doubtful that you can survive. Think of the French resistance, for example. So you're really doubtful you can survive, but you're going to resist anyway. And there have been times politically where I've certainly felt that way. And maybe some of the if Occupy is in fact sort of disintegrating, which I'm not saying it is, but it's one scenario, we have to get stuck in. We have to say, this is a time for resistance. I see it as a positive thing. You know? But, you know, that's not the only scenario by any means. Reform, again, working class tries for the path of least resistance. I think as leftists, as socialists, Marxists, anarchists, etc., we should be for anything that helps the working class. We should not see reforms as setting back consciousness. We should see reforms as a way to build revolutionary consciousness. And this partially comes from some of what Trotsky brought to Marxist methodology, this thing called the transitional method, or the transitional program, which is, hey, seize on these demands that the working class thinks are important and push the envelope. Widen the struggle. Hey, that's a great demand. We totally agree with $1 an hour raise in the contract. But we also agree with trying to organize the union beyond where it's organized. We need to get more people in the union. We also think we have to go on what, we wouldn't use this term, but what's, you know, legally a sympathy strike. We need to get other unions to go on strikes, even though it's illegal. Here's why we need to do this. So, you know, there's ways that reform can strengthen revolutionary movements. And it's an absolute necessity. I mean, I like the title here, the three R's. Right? What is the three R's? What does that bring up in our heads? Reading, writing, arithmetic, right? The basics. But think about the basics. You always go back to the basics. You use the basics over and over again. You build on the basics. And you're always, and the greatest theoreticians are always saying, well, you know, the hardest point I've reached at the end of all this is how to, I'm back to the beginning again. I'm trying to figure out the basic questions again. I'm trying to figure out how to explain the basic questions as clearly as possible. And that's, of course, any organizer, whether it's for a union movement or revolutionary movement, that's what you have to do over and over again. 1 minute. So when I'm, for example, discussing with people, I could be meeting with someone, and I've done this, with tons of academic credentials, or I could be meeting with a worker that's never graduated high school, and I find actually the discussions are similar. You have to go to those basics of struggle. With 30 seconds left, what can and should those on the left, those interested in working towards social emancipation, do tactically, strategically, et cetera? Well, I don't have time to elaborate on this, but I would say don't forget the union movement. Workers organized at the point of production and distribution can stop society and have the skills to build a new society. And that sounds, simplistic. I'm just, for time, I'm giving you the headline here, you know. Get stuck in for the labor movement. Get stuck into anything, any youth struggle. Obviously, right now, it's Occupy. It's the anti-education debt in education. And Electra, and this could be maybe part of the wider discussion. I'll finish in 2 seconds, sorry. Electropolitics. If you get a copy of Justice, we explain that position. We have a whole article where we're sort of trying to engage in a friendly polemic with the Occupy movement as part of the Occupy movement in many, many places. And we talk about what we mean by getting involved in electoral politics and why we can't just ignore that. And finally, you know, we would argue, and again, this requires a lot more discussion, that there is a necessity for building, out of that electoral struggle, building a workers' party, and out of the whole struggles that will come from that, there is a need for a revolutionary party. We don't have a narrow definition of that. It will be broad, it will have many streams, as would the World Workers' Party. So for time's sake, I have to stop there. There's a lot more. I like the format. It's very interesting. And I hope we can continue the discussion.
Thank you very much.
So I'm Joe. I do thank Travis for inviting me to speak here. I was asked to speak as a member of the Kasama Project, in which I am a participant. I won't be speaking primarily as a representative of Kasama today, but I would love to refer you all to the website, which is kasamaproject.org, K-A-S-A-M-A, project.org, where I think it's a pretty lively site. I will talk a little bit about Kasama, and then try to provoke a little bit, particularly to provoke on the basis of the flyer for this conference, which puts resistance in quotation marks, and I'd like to maybe zoom in on those quotation marks, which I think are very much Pustone's quotation marks, and I think are one-sided and undialectical. One divides into two when it comes to resistance, and I think we being the people in this room, need to take that more seriously. Okay, so Kasama. A few words about Kasama first. Kasama is united around two points of unity. Revolution and reconception. One, revolution, we share the belief that the present capitalist system by its very nature is exploitative, unjust, and unsustainable, that it is incapable of meeting the needs of humanity now and in the future, that it is fundamentally not reformable, and that it must be overgrown and overthrown to make something radically better and new possible. We are for revolution and for what we still dare to call communism, a society where the reign of exploitation is broken, class society is abolished, and where the host of oppressive ideologies, institutions, and practices that compound misery for billions of people on this earth and devastation for the earth itself are transcended, a world of global and mutual human flourishing, where the principle of from each according to ability to each according to need is put into practice. We are for revolution. Two, we are for communist reconception. The second point of unity shared by members of Kasama in various ways is that we
what we call for reconception, or reconception is the basis for regroupment. That is to say, we're not simply for stitching together the actually existing radical left around basic common denominators or shared principles or demands, as much as we may strategically support united front efforts in particular conjunctures. We believe that theoretical reconception, I think we may share this with Platypus, believe that theoretical reconception, deep and drawn out debate, the interrogation of often unquestioned premises, and the critical a critical all-sided reevaluation of past and present socialist and communist experience remains essential to forging the basis for the reemergence of a new radical movement and a new, fresh communist egalitarian pole within that movement, whatever we may end up calling it. We seek to create a communist movement that is committed to listening, not just to speaking, to the masses of people, and that understands how to speak to the people in ways that matter, ways that neither underestimate the people's openness and their ability to grasp truly radical revolutionary ideas and prospects, nor that talks over their heads and behind their backs exclusively. We are willing to admit our own ignorance and foreground that fact, the brute fact that we do not have and that we believe, I believe anyway, that no actually existing radical group in the U.S. today has the plan, the program, the strategy, let alone the forces at present to necessary for building and carrying through a socialist communist revolution in this country, and linked, of course, to developments around the world, would certainly not be a strictly national phenomenon, as I understand it, potentially. We do, however, need such a plan and strategy, and we are committed to helping to construct it in concert and in conversation with others. And I refer you to the website, but also if you're interested, I mean, we do have a kind of, an ecumenical communist circle that meets regularly under the name of Red Horizon in the city of Boston, and we would love to have your feedback, your participation. Switching gears a bit. Pardon me. So, I believe, capitalism is intolerable. Whatever its productive, you know, it's amazing, it's a contradictory system that has made possible human liberation in many ways that hadn't been conceivable before, but it's intolerable. The goal is communism. Revolution is necessary. These are basic but profound points that must be reflected, I believe, back into our thinking and our practice as we relate in the here and now to both reform struggles and a resistance that emerges and is always emerging all the time. In other words, we must constantly be asking ourselves and one another, even as we engage these movements and these resistance, spontaneous resistance that emerges, how can we fight for reforms or, as seems more likely to me, frankly, in these days of austerity and budget cutting, how can we fight against the oppressive and exploitative reforms and support resistance and help to build it, fan the fires of resistance, in a revolutionary way? Now, Poston's point in the quoted essay that frames this forum, History and Helplessness, is profound. I mean, an insightful, I think, in many of the things it says about the Iraq movement, the anti-Iraq war movement, particularly and very attentive to the problematic and even the ways that some of the resistance that emerged around Iraq war under the name of the heading of anti-imperialism appears to him and perhaps to others in Platypus who frequently refer to the study as fetishized or reified in its form, in some sense. Poston argues that much of what goes under the name of resistance shares this feature. You know, Poston takes up the Manichaean or dualistic fetishizing as well as the historically anachronistic Cold War kind of layover tendencies within the post-9/11 anti-war and anti-imperialist movement. And I can imagine Poston, I'm not sure what he said lately, but or people that hold closely to his theories in this regard, crafting a similar, perhaps insightful in some ways, but also one-sided and undialectical line with respect to OWS, Occupy Wall Street. After all, aren't these occupiers, I speak as one of them, and their supporters fetishizing Wall Street and with it banker greed and corruption is the source of the problem? Rather than developing a sophisticated understanding of the ubiquitous abstract networks of capital and the need for determinate negation of those coordinates, aren't these occupiers reproducing a problematic anti-capitalist, quotes, necessary, populism that depends on a false binary between speculation or parasitism on the one hand and good old productive, production for use on the other? And I'm going to say many people are, and many people aren't. And I would argue that many people, perhaps most of the people and most of the occupations, are presently locked in a struggle over precisely how to understand and how to engage the Wall Street speculation, capitalism, government nexus. And it's here that revolutionary Marxists and communists, perhaps
informed by Mao's statement that one divides into two, that we ought to be working overtime to make the most of that line and to win people to a properly radical revolutionary perspective. In conversation and through common work with people, not simply preaching at them or handing them literature that spells it all out. Not just theoretically, but practically. Not just from the sidelines, but from the thick of the mix. I have it from Frederick Jameson. Now, it's a secondhand quote. I don't have it in writing. But in order to fight it, you have to reify it. That is to say, a certain, if taken in its isolation, false incomplete fetishization and false concretization of the system is necessary to take a stand anywhere against it in a way that opens up the possibility of extending those theoretical apparatuses and popularizing them. One divides into two. I think we need to take subjectivity seriously within our movement. Symbols, language, and culture. To engage the people's consciousness and in the form of mass movements and in other, you know, in pockets of culture and everyday life as it exists, not as we would like it to be. Yet without compromising, and this is a real difficult thing to do, without compromising or suppressing, in essence, our revolutionary perspectives, our Marxist understandings of the causes of what's going on, about the causes driving capitalist exploitation and crisis, about the fundamentally unreformable tendencies of capitalism towards imperialism, militarism, ecocide, or pick your poison. But at the same time, we need to find ways to translate our radical ideas, our Marxism, anarchism, socialism, communism, into popular terms, into forms that are practically relevant to what people are seeing, thinking, and doing, what they are actually resisting, and the terms in which that they conceive of it as they act, even in ways that well, may have much to teach us, as well as much to learn from those of us who have devoted our lives to studying this beast. The people are capable, I want to say, of grasping bold and radical ideas. We ought not to underestimate their ability to grasp them. Even more so, however, when we take the pains to make them available to the people in their own language. Now, that's what I wrote in preparation for today. Now I'd like to share a clip as much time as I have. I know I read fast, so hopefully I have... How much time do I have?
About 5.
Okay. I'd like to start with by reading a selection from, reading the start of an attempt to precisely do this, to engage with the Occupy movement in the introduction to a journal that I had, Cultural Logic, which was mentioned, which is a Marxist journal, but in the course of introducing this issue, I tried to engage with the Occupy movement. And particularly to press on what I think are some of the ways in which the rhetoric, the kind of, what, from one standpoint, might be the reified terms of the resistance that Occupy is taking in its dominant forms, actually has radical potential that we ought to take seriously in practice and in theory. Okay, so as we sit here today, it is at a moment when it seems possible, or has seemed possible recently, to bring together the terms culture and crisis in new and interesting ways. New and exciting ways. The ruptures in the base have worked their way up to the superstructure. When it is possible, it seems again possible to speak of fundamental truths in all sorts of unexpected places with unexpecting people. Over the past year, our global situation has shifted and shaken before our very eyes and beneath our feet. The long suppressed, the sheer scandalous fact of economic inequality, the widening awareness of crises being built into the very nature of the economic setup has broken into the open, and a new language has spread across the body politic like an infection or perhaps the cure for one. Occupy, occupy, we are the 99%. Truths once whispered here in the belly of the beast are now shouted. Cabbies are having a ball with it, in my experience. Ideas kept alive by lonely souls staring into flickering computer screens are painted across banners and taken up together down main streets. Cracks in the ruling walls show, and below them, catching the light that spills through, buds for a thousand blossoms stretch their roots for nourishment. After a long series of compound crises for the left, for the working classes, and for the world, with dangers escalating all the time, a radical opportunity is suddenly upon us. A new way of speaking suggests new radical possibilities that lay just beyond the horizon. We step towards that red horizon, uncertain, but with newfound courage, reminded of the possibility of emancipatory surprise. And I'm going to jump a bit here because of the obvious short of time. You know, more than mere protests, the occupations have become spaces, and at their best are spaces, and I think should be engaged as spaces for the sharing of ideas, schools for interrogating the system we are up against, while maintaining a sustained public presence, where possible, to remind people elsewhere of the issues at stake, setting off sparks to incite further rebellion. from Occupy the Hood to Occupy the Barrio to the halls of Harvard University, where there's another Occupy. That's just a taste. The Occupy movement is the militant, can be seen as the militant motley other of the cynical straitjacket system it defines itself against. More than merely an indignant reaction to immediate justice, it breathes carnival and experimentation, open to unrealistic ideas, to new methods and to discussions about fundamental questions, learning as it goes, sustained by an infectious enthusiasm that exceeds the grasp of those who ask it. What does it demand? Does it not have demands? Occupy, for the most part, does not seek redress, despite attempts by the Democratic Party or whatnot that we're hearing a lot about, nor permission or approval from the state or even from the 1%. Rather, at its best, the Occupy movement works to expose the ruling elite and their system to the rest of the 99%, confident, even audacious in the truth that if this 99% can find a way to come together, then all the towering wealth and power of that 1% and the 0.1% can be overcome. As a chant at Occupy Boston had it, we are many, they are few, when if we all stand up, what could they do? The very existence of the occupation authorizes the raising of voices elsewhere, the voicing of truth in places that are built on its exclusion. Similarly, the experience of collaboration and sustained common work that the occupations have offered and the uncompromising determination they have represented pulls against the fragmentation, isolation, and cynicism of this terminal capitalist age. Even miles away from an encampment, even weeks after encampments have been overrun, we carry in our mind a common space, a symbol of the commons. Our minds continue to be occupied by the tasks to be done. I have 2 minutes. The prevailing rhetoric of the movement, we are the 99%, whatever its limits as strict descriptive sociology, and perhaps its lack of engagement with the question of what is the engine driving the inequality in the first place, right? The structural relationship of capital and labor, as we understand it, I'm sure very similar in different ways. You know, but the, whatever its limits, it's restored the outline of a dialectical concept of class to American life, and with it a populist frame that holds great potential. The content of We Are the 99%'s banner is not in any static identity of the mass of the people, but in their common enemy, the 1%, against which we unite subjectively, even as our precise class position may vary. The banner's value is partly in how it points the finger at those who control and benefit from an economic and political system that operates at the expense of the vast majority of humanity, not to mention other living creatures on the planet. Which finger it points, I leave to the reader's imagination. Of course, it can be argued that the 99% to 1% frame does not adequately specify the structural cause of the social inequality it protests. Where is this inequality produced? What accounts for this social division? Isn't it ultimately necessary to root our understanding of contemporary income or wealth inequality in the capital-labor relationship at the point of production? Well, yes. But at the other hand, the numerical frame and its very abstraction suggests the way that many today, particularly in the service economy and the post-industrial USA, those are limiting terms, but they have a certain point to them, perceive exploiting and profit-making, that many people do, as so pervasive that it is to be grasped not only as imminent to the point of production, but as diffused throughout the entire society, ensnaring the realms of circulation, distribution, and consumption, and occupying that, you know, people self-conscious of the exploitation going on in those realms as much as any place else. It infuses even the very scheme-scorched air we breathe, the exploitation. Its abstraction may be symptomatic and limiting and yet productive in its openness, at least for now. Okay, and this will be the last point. Similarly, the value of the 99% notion goes beyond its identification of a clear, if abstract, class enemy. It also evokes the actual and reaches towards the potential power of the organized and mobilized masses themselves. In this, it points beyond the stabilizing rhetoric of the quote-unquote middle class, long proclaimed to be the only class in America. And it excites, occupies 99%, excites subjects to militancy and courage, I believe, precisely because it does so. It points beyond the rhetoric of victimization that predominates in what mainstream U.S. discourse there is about class inequality, sociology departments, etc. It conjures the possibility of popular power, and I think we need that, even if it is a fantasy, to get to deal with the cynical age we're in, if it's a projection of possibility more than an actuality. As one recent Occupy poster put it, and I look forward to raising it again with you, comrades, 99-1, those are great odds. Thank you.
I thought it was 8 o'clock, which means there will be no discussion until 8:30.
Well, we can, we started a little late, so after you give your presentation, we can maybe fold in the responses and the question and answer.
Yeah, that's okay.
Your comments.
Well, I guess I'll say a few things that may be provocative here, but reflect what I think. For one, I think there's a danger in Marxism. I think there's a danger in dialectical materialism in that many people read it and stop thinking and treat Marx's theory of causation, whether it's the economy or what capitalism is or what it will become or the nature of the state or any number of things, as the last word. I think people take dialectical materialism, which was a fusion of different theories of European thought, a merger of idealism, one might say, coming from people like Kant, and, romantic theories, which were much more pointed towards the ground, but, people take that as the last word, too. And I think it's dangerous to take these theories out of historical context and to stop thinking. So I just want to say that as someone who's, spent a lot of time, around these issues. There's a real danger there. I believe that there's not been a serious, far-reaching left program for the U.S. economy since the 1950s, basically with the decline of, in American sort of left circles, the decline of bureaucratic, repressive socialism as evidenced in the Soviet Union, particularly. There's really been very little sort of serious kinds of thinking about the economy on the left. And I think what gave leftism momentum in the U.S. since the 50s primarily were national liberation movements from Vietnam, many African countries, all the way to South Africa in 89. And also the black movements in this country, the civil rights movement, the black power movement, the anti-war movement that was mentioned earlier. But neither the black power movement nor the anti-war movement had a serious program for the economy either. These were, limited demands in the war, civil rights, voting rights, different rights, but not a far-reaching sort of critique and program for the economy. The labor movement after World War II, in my opinion, was mostly a share the spoils movement with big firms. Give us our piece of the pie. It was mainly a movement of white workers working in concert with big business. It didn't have a real transformative vision for the economy either. And in my opinion, and here's one of the areas where, you could say I deviate a lot from traditional Marxism, and that is, I think Marxism from the beginning marginalized issues of race, culture, and psychology, and the interrelationships of those things to politics and the economy, the ultimate shape of the economy. I think the industrial era is over in the U.S., and Marx's theory of proletarian revolution was proven wrong. The working class did not form a conscious proletariat in this country. It never happened. There is no working class in this country in the sense of a self-conscious class. It doesn't exist. And I think that's largely because of race and culture in this country, and I think that's a fact. And the era is over, and I think people need to come to grips with that. Now, I don't blame Marx. He died in 1882. But I think that's what's happened. My own view is that we no longer live in a capitalist society. If you define capitalism as bourgeoisie controlling the means of production, that doesn't exist for the most part. That's not how our economy is structured. Most big companies are public companies. Their stocks are traded on Wall Street. Most of their owners are huge numbers of small investors. Most of them. Most big capital are funds like pension funds or institutional funds. These are monies, retirement savings, owned by millions of people. Now, they're managed by Goldman Sachs and other big firms like that. But the managers are not the owners of that capital. They're managers. The money supply of credit is controlled by the Federal Reserve, which is a public institution. Now, with all of these things, we can say, well, they seem very private. They seem very, you know, very much like the bourgeoisie was controlling them before. But that's because they're not democratized. But the machinery is all there for social and democratic control of the economy. What I think we have is actually something worse than capitalism. In a ways, it's a kind of autocracy that's developed due to a lack of active democratic and public direction and control of these institutions. But to say these institutions are capitalist in the way that Marx thought about capitalism, I think is not thinking. It's not really looking at how the economy is structured. It's going on platitudes from almost 150 years ago. I think the problem is that the left in this country and the public at large has no idea how to run the modern economy. And workers' pensions, for example, in this country are over $7 trillion, almost 30% of all stock on Wall Street. I work a lot with trade unions. You know, I can tell you, the AFL-CIO, Change to Win, these unions, they have absolutely no program for what to do with their trillions of pension dollars. Absolutely no program for that. The Comptroller of New York, you mentioned, I worked in New York City politics for a long time. The Comptroller of New York right now is John Liu. He's elected. He's a Korean-American from Queens, won largely with a lot of black and Latino votes. He controls directly. He doesn't report to anybody. $110 billion. The Comptroller before him was Billy Thompson, African-American from Brooklyn. He had, you know, same thing. In their election campaigns, which I pay a lot of attention to, there was no debate at all on where should he invest $110 billion. No discussion. It was all personality politics, you know, other aspects of the office, but not what to do with $110 billion. Last year, San Jose, California, the city council said, in solidarity with, you know, the movements against the big banks and others, they said, we're going to take our money out of these predatory big banks, $2 billion. Then they had a crisis. Where do we invest $2 billion? It's people's retirement money. You just can't, like, waste it. You can't lose money on it. Where are they going to put it? They couldn't find any institutions that had the capacity to invest $2 billion in ways that met their social criteria. There were no institutions that were sort of progressive kinds of institutions that did green, that didn't do, you know, high road jobs. There weren't investment banks capable of handling. Didn't exist. Occupy is defensive mostly. I think it's good that there's a fight. But saying the economy should be democratic begs the question of specifying exactly what that means in practice, sector by sector, in the economy. How do you want it to look like? I've been working in the last few years on a small section of the economy focused on energy with labor unions, community groups, all kinds of groups. And we're just like at the tip of the iceberg, and we have a lot of groups around the table fighting. We even have some parts of the Obama administration helping us. Still, it is a straight uphill battle, even in that small part of the economy. When I worked in New York City government, and I'll end with this, we spent all our time organizing, fighting to win control of that office. When we got control of that office, we only had a program for 1.5 departments. We had some notion of what we wanted for housing, particularly homelessness and, you know. And we knew enough about finance to say we wanted all of our money out of South Africa. And we did get all of our money, which was $60 billion, out of South Africa in 6 weeks. But we had 80 departments and a program for 1.5. And I say that to say, when we were running that, it was a progressive coalition, you know, a lot of general agreement with a lot of things that were said here. But when we had the opportunity to actually work in 80 different sectors of the economy of a city and actually make changes. We only had a program for one department, one and a half. That's it. And I think I've seen the same thing happen with Tony Villaraigosa, which, by the way, he used to be in a Marxist-Leninist Mao Zedong collective, right? He's no conservative. He doesn't have a program for L.A. Doesn't have it. And I see this over and over and over again with trade union leaders, with elected officials, and I think our problem is developmental. Yes, there are obstacles in our way. There are battles to be fought. But we're not even engaging them in battle. We're not even challenging the investment priorities of the people who are really running this economy. We're talking generalities. And I think our challenge is to revolutionize ourselves, is to revolutionize this conversation amongst the people who actually are the owners now of most corporations, of most of Wall Street, but are not educated. And the business schools are not going to train us or working people on how to take care of their own money and invest it in directions that we want, et cetera, that are in their you know, enlightened interests or whatever. They're not going to educate anybody on that. So I see that as the challenge. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. So I have a few comments, but I'd like to, I guess in the interest of time, we can, I'm going to have share some of my comments, and then maybe we can fold them into question and answer. So first of all, I want to start with Phil, actually. Something you said struck me, that we have something worse than capitalism, and it might be due to a lack of democratic involvement, or maybe it forecloses on certain forms of democratic practice. And you also started by saying that Marxism and sort of a lot of the sort of maybe ideas that are floating around here owe their formulation to Kant. You mentioned Kant, and that there's sort of this like liberalism. And I thought this was actually interesting. And I wanted to know, and maybe we can talk about this later, but I do want to know, where does democracy come from? Where does the forms of democracy that we have, where do they originate? And it seems to me that almost you were suggesting that Marxism and democracy itself share a certain kind of intellectual and practical history. Now, I'd like to also say that something that I mentioned in the beginning happens to be Kolakowski's concept of the left. Kolakowski says in that which, you know, is a sort of new left, a good symptom of the new left. And he says that the left bless tools utopia, that utopia has a direction for the left, and that the struggle is sort of a constant attempt to reconcile the utopia with historical reality. And what I've noticed today in a lot of the things that have been discussed here is clearly there's no lack of formulation that there are certain problems for practice, for political progressive practice. And it was quite striking, actually, that the degree to which I think that came out, that we all, everyone had their own way of sort of talking about it. And you, Gage, mentioned that there's not an opportunity for revolution. Jeff mentioned that he gets demoralized thinking of the sort of revolutionary optimism. And so I just want to suggest maybe or think about this, go back to the notion of resistance and whether it might be a moment that we're living in. So that's to go back to the Postone in a more open-minded way and not necessarily, you know, again, as a thesis, but that maybe there's a certain problem that is posed, that we have a sort of limitations on our practice. And it is indeed possibly this inability to reconcile a utopian vision with historical reality. And so in that way, resistance leaves us with a sort of rationalization for defeat, that indeed resistance could have been before a maybe more meaningful, depending on the sort of, you know, moment, but that that it's not that resistance itself is a problem, and I think that people seem to agree, but instead that it's a sort of definitive of our moments and poses strict limitations for how we can involve ourselves in struggling for freedom. the kinds of freedoms that we are able to actually articulate. So I want to, so those are two questions. If anyone has something to say right away, it would be great. But we can, you know, sort of use these responses, and then right after, if you have a question, raise your hand.
Well, I just wanted to make one quick connection to what Phil had said. I mean, the way he engaged resistance was by, not so much directly, but by saying, well, it's all well and good to have to know what you're against, but what do you do when you actually have access to power, right, to some extent, right? No, which I just think is, I mean, that's a question. I don't really have an answer to it. But I just, my thought has been, though, generally, that Occupy has not simply been that, you know, protest or resistance, but has, insofar as it's established spaces and new networks, is, you know, has provided people with something of an opportunity to exercise power in, at least in the, if you might say, the joints in the, you know, system in certain pockets, not certainly in the, with an $80 billion city agency, but hopefully, but we should be thinking about it, I guess, at some point.
I wanted to kind of pick up on a few things everybody said. One thing that Phil said about what we have is worse than capitalism, I want to agree with that and then say we have capitalism, being kind of contradictory there, and not to, and also I wanted to, when talking about how people tend to reify Marxism, and tend to stop thinking, I think it's really important. I can't tell you how many discussions I've seen where somebody wants to argue who the real Marx is, and I don't think that's helpful. Marx has been dead for, you know, well over a century now. Let's let him lie and look at the, and be critical. But I think one thing when we talk about this, situation here, when we talk a lot about management, I think we need to, I think one of the things that makes struggle harder now, and while we're, it makes it a little harder to, that utopian vision, to make it a little harder, make it line up with reality or to reconcile it, I think one thing is it's no longer clear. We're not in this age where there's the group of very tiny group of wealthy capitalists who absolutely have this strict ownership of the means of production. We're not in that industrial, slightly post-industrial revolution era of industrialism, single capitalists and everything. We're in this era where everybody just, the shares are spread around and everybody's managing, and I think more and more people are the face of capital to other people, and people are both the face of capital and the person victimized by capital at varying times in their life. So I think, in a way, capital has run away from human control. Obviously, there's still these dramatic differences in social position and prestige and power and resources. Obviously, that's still occurred, but I don't think that that's the core of what capitalism. Capitalism is about alienation and everything, and I think that makes it very hard to envision what struggle against it is. Mm-hmm. It's probably, for a peasant in feudalism, it's probably struggle against, you know, the nobility taking their prerogatives and taking some of their harvest and change the land is a very easy struggle to envision. You have the immediate there. Struggle against capitalism, it's very hard to even talk about our utopias. I can't tell you how many arguments I've had over what communism looks like, and everybody just ends up looking silly because how can you envision something that is so fundamentally different than recorded history has ever shown? And I think that brings us, and Phil also talked about race in America, and I think that also brings us to Occupy. I have this theory, and I think other people have stated it before, that the ferocity of Occupy and why we see, like you talked about the composition in the 60s, why we see such a, and I realize middle class is a very problematic term, but if we look at the economic benefits given to white workers during the era of Keynesianism, we've seen those be chipped away. And I think Occupy is finally, people have realized with this crisis of a crisis that we've had the last few years, we've had the carpet pulled out from them, and finally white people are realizing they're working class. That they we haven't conquered class as a society, and they're realizing this. And I think what they're seeing is all of a sudden white people are starting to get a taste of how people of color have been treated in the U.S. And I think that's why we see this, the ferocity of Occupy, and like what happened, I did everything I was supposed to. I was supposed to, you know, have a nice house and a good job and be stable. I played my part. And I think that's where we're seeing some of that lashing out come from. And I think, you know, race in America is why movements here have looked very different than they looked in other places because of that problematic. So I think, you know, that's a driving thing in Occupy. I think now that there are still things I think that, you know, are not part of the experience of most white people, and obviously white is a problematic category because groups are brought into whiteness over time. That I think more now it's more not facing an excess of repression than having economic benefits. So I think that's changed. So I think we are at an era of where things are all turned upside down. And it makes it even harder because we can't use the things that we would have used 20 or 30 years ago, which probably weren't, you know, all that great because did we have revolution 20 or 30 years ago? But it's even harder to line up our utopia with reality right now because I think it's hard to get our footing.
Do I get to say something, too? How long do I have?
Five minutes.
Okay. Well, trying to say this as politely as I can. One of the things that I think we should all struggle with, myself included, is to have an international perspective on not just forms of struggle and organization, but on basic, let's say, testing of Marxism. If you take a picture right today of a factory in China or Vietnam, it's looks like a picture of a factory in the United States in the 1930s. It's incredibly labor-intensive. The factory floor is densely populated. The factory floor is like an aircraft hangar. You know, the idea that there's no more proletariat, the idea that the working class is so atomized, that we're post-industrial, all that, just, you know, buy a plane ticket. You know, go to India, go to China, go to Vietnam. It's alive and well. And, you know, a lot of people in general, they think
what's the word?
I mean, I do this too. I'm not trying to say people are ignorant for this, but we respect authority. We're taught to respect authority, even on the left. So we throw out people's names. So I'm going to throw out a name, Mike Davis. You probably know who he is. He's a writer, formerly in the Communist Party, I believe, at one point. So Mike Davis, if you want to see the future of Marxism, you know, go to China. And there's the industrial proletariat, more numerous than ever before in history. I agree with what Gage was getting at in terms of the working class right now, regardless of color, regardless of gender, in the United States, is being thrown back into a more obvious working class position. And just because a lot of Americans go around, and this is certainly true, people in my family and people I know, and don't consider themselves working class, doesn't mean we're not working class. You know, just because we don't consider ourselves working class, the consciousness does not obviate the objective reality of our lives, the material reality of our lives. So if you I would just suggest, I mean, I've had professors since I was 17, before that, tell me Marxism is dead and useless and don't read that. Read this essay by A.J.P. Taylor that says Marxism is crap before you dare read the Communist Manifesto. I suggest you go directly to the text if you're interested to get some tools to take you through the struggles or the lack of struggles that are about to happen in front of us. And one text is the Communist Manifesto. Read it directly. Oh, surprise, it talks about globalization. Lenin's imperialism talks about the economy as, you know, the trends that still exist in the economy that we exist under. Read State and Revolution, and all the same questions we're debating every day with, and I used to be an anarchist when I was younger, that are in our heads or that we're debating with other anarchists, with anarchists, those questions are outlined there. And I found that, by the way, and I don't mean this as an attack, it's just most anarchists that I've talked to, they've been scared away, so scared away from Lenin, they won't dare read State and Revolution. So Marxism is an open system, not a closed system. It's a scientific system, not one based on a set of ideas or principles. And a lot of it is useless. But a lot of it, the methodology, the basic core methodology of it, is being proven, actually, time and time again, by capitalism, by the inequalities under capitalism, by the class struggle under capitalism, by the wars and the ecocide, as someone said. I've never heard that term before, but it's very apropos. I mean, we're in a battle here for the survival of the planet. I don't mean to be melodramatic, but I mean, capitalism can destroy or render practically useless the environment. Capitalism can bring up the conditions for nuclear war again. And there's no guarantee that any kind of left alternative, socialism included, will be successful. But what I find happening again and again in my lifetime, and historically from what I've read, is that revolution, class struggle continues. The proletariat actually is growing in number. And that revolutionary struggles present themselves from time to time. Again, to go back to the Arab Spring, go back to what's happening in many countries right now, countries like Kazakhstan, countries in Greece. I mean, why is there low class consciousness in this country is basically what I said earlier, in my opinion, the lack of a mass movement in recent memory, in generational memory. It's not there. So there's no traditions of mass struggle in people's heads. The first thing people don't think of when they lose a job is not to go, you know, join with other people and fight to keep their job. They think, I got to scramble and get another job, you know, or that I got to find a way to make a living on my own, you know, without even going for a job. I got to open a cleaning business or something. I got to do something. But it's also, I'll finish on this. Yeah, it's also the lack of a workers' political party, and it's a point I'd like to elaborate on, but I don't have time. Without that, in recent memory in the United States, there's no way that historical class clashes can be kept alive. It's a material process. There's no institution out there putting out enough information in a material way that we as working people can learn about our own situation for the most part. I'll end with that. It requires a lot more explanation, but I'll end with that.
I can respond.
So Joe has something quick to say, and if you have something to say, I really am anxious to get the audience, but Phil hasn't had it.
Can I?
Yeah, go ahead.
I would just to clarify a few things I said. I've seen factories in Brazil. I understand that some countries have traditional factories just the same way we did here. I specifically said that the industrial era is over in the U.S. I didn't say in the whole world. I said in the U.S. I said that there is no working class or proletariat in the U.S. as a conscious class for itself. I didn't say there's no such thing as people who don't own means of production, who work for a living, get a salary. I read Marx. I read Wages, Price, and Profit. I know that theory. That's not what I said. So, but I challenge anyone to show me where this class-conscious proletariat is in the U.S. or ever was in the U.S. I said Marx's theory of revolution was wrong. He said socialism would emerge where the productive forces were most developed, like the United States or Britain. Wrong. Didn't happen. China, he didn't predict that. That was just wrong. You said, workers follow the path of least resistance. I agree with that. But that wasn't Marx's theory of where workers' consciousness will lead. That was not his theory. I would say, I agree with you. So my question then is, so what does that mean in terms of your theory of revolution? Where does revolution come from? How does revolutionary consciousness develop then? I think it's a challenge. I don't think Marx had it down. I don't think he understood it, really, or it solved it. I don't think. That's all I'm saying.
You want to finish it, sir.
The other thing I want to say, in terms of origins of Marxism and democracy, I would say this. Marx said white workers in the U.S. South have false consciousness. And I think Marx had somewhat a mechanical sort of theory about how people develop revolutionary consciousness. Because I don't think workers' racism was false consciousness. I think that was very real consciousness. And an intelligent racism, not a stupid racism, that has persisted in this country and people benefited from it. And I think people's sense of being a citizen in this country, if you were white historically, meant, well, that means I don't get to be a slave. And it was always posed as against this black other that I won't be at the very, very bottom getting lynched, you know, not having anything. And I think that's been a serious drag in terms of your path of least resistance, on any kind of revolutionary consciousness in the U.S. But nothing false about it, because the alternative was very real, you know, in terms of slavery. So, and in terms of democracy, there are 1,000 definitions of democracy, but if you say the mechanistic sort of approach historically, during Marxist time, majority rule means freedom. Well, it only means freedom if the majority is not united by religious prejudice or racial prejudice, because if it is, democracy just means tyranny if you're in the minority. And that's just another mechanical approach to thinking about democracy. And there was a lot of mechanical thinking during Marxist time. So in that sense, they do share a lot of those origins of the time. Marx had a stage theory. First there's feudalism, then there's capitalism, and then there's socialism. That's a stage theory. It was very popular during that time. We don't believe that now. Stage theories aren't popular anymore. But during Marx's time, it was. This isn't to put down Marx, who's an incredible thinker, who I think would not be saying the same thing now as he was in 1882. It's just to say, to repeat this stuff right now and not pay attention to what's happened in the last 130 years, to me, it's not getting us anywhere. It's just not getting us anywhere.
Oh yeah, I just want to say I had the opportunity to teach the Communist Manifesto. I'm all for reading the Communist Manifesto. It's inspired me at various times in my life. I had the opportunity to teach it to a couple of different groups of undergrads recently, and I was struck by how, in some sense, anachronistic a lot of the claims about the formation of revolutionary subject formation are in that text to me today. Which is to say, but at the same time, I find that it's a chart of the objective laws. Yes, it's globalization's there. Yes, there's so many ways in which he's charting what's happening with capital. But it just raises the question again, I think, that we need to be thinking fresh. I mean, I appreciate what Phil's bringing today in the sense that, in prompting us to want to think fresh about the intersection between culture and psychology and race, as well as other, aspects of the situation. Of like, it may be the case where people are more proletarianized, more commodity form has permeated more parts of social life than ever before. The objective structures, so much capital is truer than ever. But what about the subjective side, right? What about the subjective side? And what does it mean to really take that seriously? And again, I don't mean to occupy like it's the only thing on the pedestal, but like, what was it that allowed a lot of people that hadn't stepped forward before to unite with that the notion of the 99%? And what's the dialectics of that? And I do think your point about proletarianization of middle class folks and so forth is key there. But I think there's two different ways to engage that, right? One is to say, well, they're just getting what everybody else has been getting, so like, let them go. And there's another way to think of the dynamics and the possibilities of that movement when you have kind of subjective structure and an objective structure kind of coming into a certain new kind of conflict, the kind of sparks that can give off, I think, is what, where I think we should be, like, trying to get the fire going, to put it in abstract terms. That's it.
Question.
Okay, so I think that I eventually have a question at Jeff, but I'm going to, I just have a few points that sort of, pick from some of the other speakers. One of the things that Phil spoke about was the idea that, that there is no such thing as big capital as we used to understand, the fact that, companies are actually owned by millions of people, and that there is the machinery for sort of social ownership exists, but it just has not been democratized. And I was sort of, I'm trying to sort of link that back to the thing, not the quote from Postone, but the other thing that he's sort of talking about, where it's, Gates said that this is not capitalism, something worse than capitalism, yet capitalism. And so I thought that was very interesting because, it certainly seems like, we are certainly not living in Fordist, in a sort of Fordist economy anymore, but for many years now. So clearly something has changed from then. And one of the things that sort of Gage mentioned was sort of hard and angry. And the thing that sort of was interesting to me, that there's an idea that comes from Marx, but I'm going to talk about how it's been understood in the 20th century, sort of rise of the general intellect, that, if enough people if they become conscious of what they could be, that society will ultimately sort of, bring forth some sort of social change. And that certainly was the imagination that we had during the Arab Spring, that, people are rising in the streets in Tunisia, and certainly they are demanding more, and ultimately, yes, it will point towards some form of democracy. And I think that I would sort of now come to Jeff. What was interesting is that, yes, it did happen, but it didn't really happen. We lost the sort of, we lost the dictators on top, but we don't see a democratic form of society. Yes, the struggles continue, but the struggles are not certainly not pointing only in emancipatory directions. They're pointing in all sorts of directions, and most likely, if you see what happened in Egypt as well, they're actually going in sort of difficult direction, problematic, and the working class is the one that suffers, right? So to go back to what Phil was saying about sort of, you know, I think the fact that we are not living in some sort of, if you're not living in Fordism, if you're certainly living in a different moment, then I'm wondering what meaning does sort of, you know, an emphasis on working class politics in the way you sort of explained it, what that holds for us, in the sense that the building of a strong labor party as the foundation of any sort of movement towards social transformation, what does that mean? Because, you know, certainly there are no workers in the United States that actually are doing that. So what that really means to me, it sounds like, is solidarity with people in China or solidarity with people, you know, in India or in Brazil or what have you. And while you learn from them, of course, I mean, that's wonderful. But actually, I don't know what that means towards building an international workers' movement, or actually the workers' movement, would it actually perform the same role as it would have, I don't know, in the 30s or, you know, when Trotsky was trying to organize them.
How much time do I have to respond? Because I want a lot of questions.
Yeah,
I have a lot of...
Yeah, do you want to... let's take one more question, if there is one, actually. In the back?
Please.
How you
doing? So, I'm more curious about... So, I was heavily involved with this stuff in Wisconsin, and from that town. I'll tell you something about that city, that town. My grandfather was a migrant worker, and the unions there have been some of the most racist unions in the country. And I worked with the farm workers in California, the same thing we're hearing about the trade unions. And so what's happened over time, and you look at the city of Madison, Wisconsin, where 60% of the black and brown people in that city are either 18 or 35, or they're in jail or on some type of court supervision. And the area, the east and near east and west side, right around the university, where you get the folks who have been more active are the whitest districts in the city. And that's historically, that's the nature of Wisconsin labor. And this idea now, and where I'm going to go with this is to what's going on with education right now, because I think it's one of the most strategic arenas that the conservative movement has been really effective in constructing a divisive issue where we don't really have a whole lot of answers. Right now, Madison, like a lot of cities that are Milwaukee, are going through this process of privatization within their through the form of charter schools. Mm-hmm. And there really is no alternative. There's no policy alternative to dealing with it. What people are going back to is the status quo. We should support the teachers' union. But when you're looking at who ends up teaching, and you're looking at who ends up getting suspended, and who's getting kicked out of schools, it tended to look like a lot, you know, the folks who are teaching, 90% of them are white folks, and when you look at the disproportionate amount of kids who are getting kicked out of school, and so far, you know, going into prison industrial complex, and just a form of real activism, this idea that there's some type of activism. I personally, farm workers in California found Occupy the Hoods offensive. When you look at the history of occupation in our communities, we don't need occupation, we need liberation. And this idea that we need more folks coming in there to tell us what's up is historically we thought very ignorant. And so the question is, with all this stuff, so just take it back to the idea of education, to what's going on with the privatization of that public space. How do we negotiate that? What are the policy alternatives? Because if we keep going back and saying we just go back to the status quo, well, that doesn't work. And that's what's happening in communities. You've seen that happening in Los Angeles, Chicago in a big way, where you're getting predominantly communities of color who are saying to hell with the unions, to hell with that whole thing, because I know that there might be this very eloquent and esoteric reason why we should all be in solidarity. But our kids are the ones dying. Our kids are the ones on the street getting kicked out of these institutions and ending up in prison. And so we're supposed to adhere to some type of when we have no on-the-ground solutions, we have no on-the-ground action. There's no policy implications. And I just don't know, I mean, if you guys could speak to that a little bit. Name's Justice, is my name.
Sure. Just on what you're raising. I don't know, there's a lot of assumptions there. The assumption is that in Wisconsin, let's just say anyone talking about socialism in that struggle had to be white. Our main organizer there was African American. And you're right, I think that the majority of the movement there did seem to be white. I wasn't there, I didn't visit. But I know that actually through the labor movement there, despite race, of course there's racism in the labor movement, but despite that, African Americans played a role in the struggle there. And it's like what Professor Thompson got into earlier. The post-war upswing in the United States made things better for the majority of white workers, And most people of color were left out of that. But, again, using the old worn-out Marxist method, dialectically, if you look at it, there were things going on deep in the labor movement that people like Martin Luther King spoke to when he talked about the Teamsters Union, when he died on a pit, you know, supporting a picket line of African-American workers in Memphis, where he saw that of the American African-Americans that were getting a better living standards, it was those that were being organized in places like New York City, through my union, AFSCME, down in Memphis, and so on. So there's this hidden reality of the labor movement that actually fights against racism. And there's a reality of the socialist movement that, you know, people like to caricature Marxism and socialism constantly. It's the easiest thing to do in America. I think everything I'm raising here is completely fresh and brand new. Because in America, Marxism is the easiest thing to trash. It's been trashed consistently. It's just, Gore Vidal calls it anti-communism in America. It's the only state religion, you know? And that's what it is. So what we've been involved in recently, well, we tried to organize a FedEx warehouse in Brockton that was mostly African-American. Bloody stories about what the company does there. The prison solidarity is a huge thing that socialists should be involved in, that we're involved in. I just don't agree with the assumptions there. I agree with a lot of what you said, of course. Who's getting hit the hardest in education and so on? That's absolutely true. But the answer isn't to, I'm not saying you were saying this, the answer is not to go after teachers' unions. The answer is not to trash unions. The answer is to organize unions. More so, some of the most dynamic union organizing, someone in New York, in the RSDWA, whatever that stands for, and others, are being led by African Americans now. The other, getting to the other point, and I don't have time to get into it. I'm sorry, what was your
name?
Minad. There's too much to say in 1 minute, but let me throw out a few points that can be developed on by yourself or anyone. The idea that Marxists have some sort of fetish for Marx is, I don't know, not true in my experience.
Sure. Well,
Marx does not equal Marxism. Marxism is something that's constantly evolving, and Marx was certainly wrong about a lot of things. The big reason in Tunisia and Egypt and other countries that the revolution stopped, short of being social revolutions, has to do with the exact concrete history of the left and of policies by Israel and the United States in those countries. Islamicization in terms of fundamentalism that came up that happened in many of those countries is no accident, right? There's organizational
roots there. I actually save time by saying that I understand that.
Okay.
I understand the historical implications of that, but I'd rather mean the fact that workerism, in a certain sense, now means to ride on their wings.
I was getting to that real quick. The one of the things, if you go to the CWI website and look back before the Arab Spring, we were talking about the organization of workers in Egypt and how that was, you know, there was a big strike movement. There was likely going to be some sort of, mass reaction based on that. So a lot of kind of workerist, blah, blah, you know, whatever, you want to pigeonhole that, not you personally, whatever, someone wants to pigeonhole that, is actually the driving force behind a lot of that, a lot of what's happening in Tunisia, Egypt, and other countries. And two things I don't have time for, but I'll throw them out as headlines. I completely reject Professor Thompson's view of what capitalism is now. I've been on union executive boards with that question of where do you put your retirement money. Retirement money is disappearing for most workers. And anyway, I don't have time to develop that point. And the Labor Party question or the Workers' Party question I don't have time for, but there are people in the United States working for that and have worked for that in the recent past.
Question over here.
I'd like to hear his response
to what you were saying. You cannot use a European model to solve a different culture's problems. That culture puts you in a situation, and you're going to have to go back to your own history and look at the traditional forms of socialism and cooperation that work within those traditional cultures and build upon those models, because when you try to do it from a different culture standpoint, that's where all the confusion comes in. You're like, it's not working for me. It wasn't intended to work for you. The system's set up that you're going to be always sidelined, kept on the bottom. So if you are able to work together within your own community from the inside out perspective, rather than saying, why can't I fit into this system that never intended to include me? You'll be less frustrated. Once you understand that it was never intended to include you on an equal level, and that your own community needs to build itself up from the inside out, expecting the outside end solution, then you'll be much less frustrated.
Oh, yeah, no, so, I'll tell you right now, the prison system and the education system in this country are two Western institutions that work perfectly. I think they work perfectly.
And we had models
that work just like the design.
Two U.S.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think Justice's point on education is extremely important. And I feel that for me to criticize Marxism and then to be accused of anti-communism is a cop-out. And I've read all of Marx. I've read Lenin's 54 volumes. I've read Trotsky. I've read everything Mao Zedong ever wrote. That, to me, is paying respect for that knowledge. What really bothers me is the white left hasn't read Du Bois. They haven't read C.L.R. James. They haven't read Amilcar Cabral. They haven't read 100 years of constructive black criticism in dialogue with Marxism. Never read it. Never read it. And so it gets to me to this point about education. It gets to me to the point about education. Race has been a profound problem in the U.S. in terms of class development. Okay? It would seem to me, knowing that, that one would bother to read the people who were Marxists amongst blacks and who made this criticism. Martin Luther King. Four unions out of 72 supported the March on Washington. And even with them, it was a fight. I know Bill Lucey. I know the guy who called Martin Luther King on behalf of AFSCME to come to Memphis. Bill Lucey is being ostracized in AFSCME as we speak. Today. I'm just saying, racism is so deep in the labor movement, I don't know if they'll ever find their way out of it. I tease, and I work with labor. I'm not anti-labor. But every time I go to the AFL-CIO headquarters, I say, how come Harriet Tubman's picture isn't up on your wall? Black people work for 300 years with no pay. Okay? That's not labor. That's not a labor issue. You think the labor movement started when white men decided to have a union? And that's how you define the beginning of a labor movement? And working class solidarity is about unions? Because you white guys form unions? It's not about how black people organize, or how Latino people organize, or how women organize. It's about how white men organize. So we have to focus on that. You know, it's just deep. It's just deep. The whole way it's taught is deep. That's why I think education is profoundly needed. And I could go on a long time about the teachers' unions in Milwaukee. And I know folks are from Wisconsin, so I'll spare you. But I'll tell you, the conflict between the black community and the teachers' unions in Wisconsin, the same as New York, has to do with white left labor leaders treating schools as factories and treating kids as widgets. And black communities, Latino communities have said, our kids are not widgets. And we don't want you treating us as objects, right? We want you to respect who we are as people, come together, we together figure out what happens in schools. It's not a factory where it's just about you negotiating with the leadership. And the superintendent of schools and the former commissioner of labor for Wisconsin, who wrote all these contracts that the labor movement was defending, is a black Marxist who, when he became superintendent of schools, the unions treated the kids so bad, he like became Mr. Charter School. Because he said it is just impossible to build a real coalition and real solidarity. I'm just saying it's a serious problem. And I hope in Occupy, folks learn from this history. Because we still have this division. And I hope people in Occupy read Du Bois, read C.L.R. James, like really focus on educating and really try and struggle with why haven't we been able to get over this hump? Why is it in 2012 we're still talking about this? Marx was talking about this 150 years ago. We're still talking about it. Why?
And real quick, I just want to clarify, I wasn't saying, like, I'm sure that there's a lot of individuals, right? There's no doubt about that. And I know a lot because a lot of them are, you know, my friends and colleagues, that we do a lot of the good work. And it's not saying that there isn't individual cases, but the question is how do we come up with the tools to go to negotiate? Because if we don't negotiate it, it's just going to exacerbate itself. You know, it's just going to remain a very, I would say, a divisive moment that's going to impede our ability to go forward. And these things, with this charter school thing, with the privatization of public space in that arena, it's becoming very problematic because, in the meantime, that our whole public school system is being privatized, mm-hmm. you know, for better or for worse. We can talk about the history of this stuff, but if we don't come up with a plan, if we don't have a cohesive plan of action and milestones on how to go forward, it's going to be problematic. That's all I would say.
Yeah, I mean, to come back to the terms of the, you know, the of the leaflet for the discussion, the resistance, right? I mean, that very resistance to this, you know, objectifying, oppressive educational institutions and it's, you know, can then flow into another place that actually still, you know, doesn't, it loses its, you know, oppositional character, right? You know, the Marxist principle who ends up, you know, who ends up championing charter schools, whatever. Not to say that there might not be some difference that he can make in, you know, his ideology, his political ethic, whatever can make there. But he's like, if we don't, as you know, whether it's as the left or as a communist movement, give people, create spaces or work with people to create alternative spaces, whether it's program or, you know, other alternative institutions, of what a lot of that resistance to what's going on is going to flow back into channels that ultimately are just compounding the problem. Right? I mean, I think you find that in education, you can find it in other areas too, and that's a real responsibility. People are going to resist, but if there aren't the forms, and you know, where how can we help to be part of the process to bring, to make that resistance turn into something revolutionary and liberating rather than just another, you know, another fold back to, you know, to a new kind of oppression and exploitation. I mean, yeah.
Okay, so if you have something to say, I just want to flag that we're probably going to wrap up pretty soon, so I'm going to be able to say something, and then I'll take a few more questions.
I think Phil's point about how racism is not a false consciousness in the U.S. Is really important. I think you know, we can make the argument, well, white workers would be better with revolutions, so, you know, it's false consciousness, but are they better? Do they have a reasonable fear of, if I were treated like black people, is that a reasonable fear that white people have? Yeah. That's why they, if you look at the history of how groups became white, how they were brought into whiteness, and there's a lot of stuff done in the Irish and the Italians. If you look at that, a lot of times it was making that offer to them of, you know, we're going to treat you a lot better if you help enforce the race line. And I think that's really important. I think we can't just put it down as simply as, you know, black and white united by, I think there are real material differences that are really, really important to the U.S. situation. I don't think they're exactly the same as they were in the 60s, but they're still there. And I'd be willing to bet, I haven't done this research myself, but I'd be willing to bet as we've seen austerity as an attack on the upper segments of the working class, one, there's been a tremendous loss of wealth by people of color in the U.S. with this latest crisis. We need to remember the crisis started with mortgages that were ballooned with balloon payments and arms that were targeted at communities of color. Mm-hmm. And that there's tremendous loss of wealth, and I'd also be willing to bet that as, you know, white workers have seen their economic status go down, we've seen more and more police repression and expansion of the prison industrial complex, expanding on people of color to give white people some reason to continue to side with the establishment against people of color.
Creates jobs too, right? A lot of states, the biggest growing, you know, quickest growing employment area. I want to plug with the work of Ted Allen and Hubert Harrison too. I mean, I don't know, you know, one, you know, African American, Hubert Harrison, Ted Allen's work. I mean, you know, people know the invention of the white race. I don't know, which I think, I mean, and this isn't the time, but to hear your, you know, someone who's if he's trying to still work within the Marxist tradition, but who's very much taking seriously the material benefits of racism and the construction of whiteness, not simply the ideological false consciousness of it. I mean, I think there are people who work this line from within the Marxist tradition as well.
Yeah. Question, and then...
Feels like we've been kind of beating around the bush with the notion of reform. We've been talking a little bit about it. But I think the question we need to seriously ask ourselves are, what are the parameters under which reform is just a lost cause? I mean, the realities of what you were pointing out, which are very serious questions that we need to ask ourselves, are things like, how is it that we can bring around social justice and issues where the system is completely under the reform of capitalism? I mean, are reforms even possible under those type of parameters at all? Or like the very invention of the charter school, right, was a national liberation struggle. You know, that's what they're being done now. Maybe that's the parameters of reform now, but obviously charter schools are being used for things like privatizing the education system. So, you know, where is it or how is it that we see practical reforms can be made and under what parameters? So those are the questions.
And the main
question. Yes, what I wanted to comment about was how I noticed that race was very much in people's consciousness today, and it seemed like everyone at least uncritically affirm the notion that were it not for the peripheral racial minority or like, you know, the black other, et cetera, that class consciousness might have been more feasible were it not for that. And I wanted to make a comment about, do you think that with the further possibility of conditions being worse, like austerity or whatever, with a black president, what are the conditions that make capitalism go on that will sustain this kind of racist ideology? I mean, like, on the one hand, there's, you know, white people being proletarianized, so you would imagine that that would make, you know, racism be less of a problem. That's just my question.
And so if we could make these are two great questions. I think if you could make these your final comments.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that the reforms are coming down the pike are going to be largely like things we need to fight against. I don't see. Yeah, I mean, I've worked on the MBTA struggle. I mean, they're trying to jack up the price. They're trying to cut the service, right? I mean, at least just thinking on the ground here in Boston. I think that's just a great question. I'm not going to resolve it. I mean, on the racism issue, how will basically racism change or racism's function within capitalist system as a kind of divisive or issue or one that keeps proletarian subjects from deconforming. I just have a speculation on this, which seems like to me a lot of racial questions. I mean, they've always been questioned that the law has legality and criminality has always been very much involved in that nexus, but it seems to me to be even getting more foregrounded, right? This idea of, who's legal and who's illegal, who's got paper on them and who doesn't, right? So it seems to me that the racialization and kind of criminalization, I feel like they've always been bound up together, but I feel like it seems to be increasingly, I'm not saying that skin color and things like this are don't matter. I mean, obviously we've seen any number of examples recently and not recently that problematize that notion, but that idea that criminalization of peoples, and the legal status is becoming increasingly prominent in the way that some of the same functions are accomplished that maybe racism has historically accomplished, the color line, Du Bois writes about it. Yeah.
Dr. Julia, would you like to respond?
Sure. On the question of what in general I was trying to get out of my comments was that we should, as radicals, as anarchists, socialists, etc., we should have an orientation towards the labor movement. We should get stuck into the labor movement. We should try to organize unions. What my organization does is invariably any union we're in, we are fighting to strengthen the union, democratize the union, and oftentimes the union is completely useless in terms of the leadership. My job is at stake right now, and my leadership is refusing to fight at all. There's not even resistance. Resistance would be welcome as a step. I'm also trying to put forward an internationalist perspective, which I do think is lacking in this country. And it does then open up new possibilities for looking at struggle in the United States. If we confine our view to what's happening in the United States and the history that we're taught here, even from the left, even from the liberal left, we will be missing a lot, in my opinion. For example, the brother here was saying, what are some concrete forms of struggle that we can look to? Well, there's definitely some great examples in the United States around the Occupy movement, the anti-foreclosure work that's happening in many Occupy groups right now, which we're a part of, in Minneapolis. The links made between Occupy and the work done between Occupy groups in the West Coast and the Longshore Workers Union and other union struggles out there. The MBTA struggle right here in Boston. I mean, I'll throw out a controversial thing. I think Occupy has been most successful, most long-lasting, where it did take up demands. MBTA work, there's a series of demands. The anti-foreclosure, don't foreclose the house. That's a demand, anyway, that's maybe part of a different discussion. To finish up, I think that the discussion on racism is crucial. I actually agree with a lot of what Professor Thompson said, but that doesn't make me. I'm not saying he's saying this. Okay, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but it doesn't make me turn away from union struggle, and it doesn't make me turn away from the principle of working class unity, and it doesn't make me turn away from internationalism. And I'm not saying he's not looking at those things either. I'm not trying to put words in his mouth. So, for example, another answer to that question, what's a concrete struggle to point to right now in Ireland? There's this thing called the United Left Alliance. They're fighting on an issue that you couldn't imagine the left of the United States fighting on. They're fighting against a tax. They're fighting against a household tax. They're getting enormous participation in the movement from people that never got involved in politics before. And mass civil disobedience of not paying a tax the government is demanding they pay. And the Committee for Works International has done a similar movement in the past, the anti-poll tax struggle in Britain, that basically helped, was a big factor in bringing down Thatcher. And there are other mass struggles. I would argue that a lot of what we're talking about, and I didn't have time to develop this point, but I tried to in answering that question from the brother there, is a question of leadership. I would say one thing that makes us a little different in social self-turning, maybe a little more irritating, is that we do place a lot of emphasis on leadership. For example, when I was in the electoral wards, I worked a lot with Communist Party members. And in most struggles, the Communist Party members would say, well, the members just weren't ready to take that step. The members just weren't interested in that. They weren't ready, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It could be a big struggle or a small struggle. It could be a historical discussion we were having or whatever. In most of those cases, I was arguing the members were ready, or we should have at least tried to see if they were ready. Test the waters, at least. And it was actually instead a question of leadership. And that question of leadership, the crisis of leadership, which I think gets behind some of the comments that that brother raised, exists in the black community as much as in the white community. In fact, a lot of the questions are exactly the same. Do we support the Democrats or not? Key question in any community right now in the United States. Read Black Agenda Report. Read Black Commentator. Read all sorts of sources that will say, that are battling with that question, wrestling with that question, should we support the Democrats? That's a key question in the American left. And we haven't gotten over that. We have a big portion of the American left supporting the Democratic Party time after time after time. And that's a huge, huge problem in the United States. Until we break with the Democrats, we're not going to build any of the things we talked about, including being able to really fight racism, by the way, and being able to build working class unity and being able to build class consciousness, all that. A big part of that is breaking with the Democrats, but not breaking with electoral politics, but instead building a workers' party of some sort, doesn't matter what it's called, but that would not get its money from the corporations, from big business, and that would have hopefully an anti-capitalist platform or be something to be worked out in the struggle. And that's those questions take on different forms and have different immediacy, definitely, in different communities. Absolutely. You know, the cops are killing African-American youth. They're not primarily killing white youth in this country. That's obviously clear. That's a whole set of different self-defense necessary in those communities and so on. But at the end of the day, when you go to City Hall and the people that control the cops are the Democrats and the African-American leaders in that town are supporting the Democrats, how is that fundamentally different from the question that we face here in Massachusetts, where the Democrats control the MBTA fare hikes and all the other crap that we have to live with here? So, the idea of the crisis of what we use as code, the subjective factor, the mass leadership of the working class, subjective factor is very weak in this country, has to be built from the ground up, but not in isolation. And we have a lot we can learn. We have to, in the face of globalization and global capitalism, a lot we can learn from international struggles and hooking up with international struggles. For example, okay, I'll end there. Thanks. Sorry.
Sure.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Thank you. Would you
like to? Yeah, I would just say I think that at the end of the day, whether, you know, to me, supporting Democrats or a third party, that's a tactical question. This foreclosure tactics. At the end of the day, I think you have to have some idea of what it is you're fighting for. And concretely, how do you want this modern economy to work? You know, sphere by sphere. I said there are 80 departments in New York. Well, break it down. How do you want these 80 different sectors to operate? And then engage in battles around that. And also deploy resources that are within hand around that. In New Orleans, the building trades invested $1.2 billion to retrofit a huge public housing complex after Katrina. The Bush administration totally freaked out and tore down the buildings rather than let the building trades come in there with a positive program on rebuilding the city. That, it was amazing. The building trades also put up $10 billion for energy projects. They did this 3 months ago. And so now we're working on creating forward-looking energy projects in places like Cleveland and bringing together the building trades and community and hospitals who need energy and da-da-da-da to actually work on what's a vision that brings us together for what we'd like to see in this sector. And I think we need to just do that. Then you get into real fights with utilities and others because you're going right for their money. You're going right for their power, and you're constructing something else. And I think we got to really work on what is that something else. So that's first thing I'd say. Second thing I'd say is I think it's very complicated when you actually lead people. So I used to manage the Housing Authority in New York, which is public housing, which is over 500,000 people. I went to tenant meetings constantly, and tenant leaders demanded more cops all the time. They wanted more cops because they were being terrorized by drug dealers and crack dealers. And so they wanted that, even though everyone's real clear in public housing on some of the bad things cops do, they were more worried, terrorized by the drug dealers. I just say that to say it's a complicated thing. And I think we just have to, you know, kind of sometimes step back and listen to people and then figure out where to go from there, as opposed to, I brought all kinds of, you know, like the NAACP, I brought them to meet with public housing residents, and they decided to talk about why black powder dealers get crack dealers should get less sentences, because white powder dealers, talking about cocaine, get longer sentences. And I had to literally protect them to keep the residents from attacking them while they were on stage, because the residents were so upset about crack dealers. And I say that to say, like, a lot of this stuff, I swear to God, we're up in our heads with the ideology. We're not on the ground. And we got to get on the ground and listen to people, like you said. And I think racism will go on under Obama, whoever's president. I don't think black people at the moment are the focal point. Right now, the focal points are undocumented immigrants in terms of the race thing. I mean, that's where... they're getting hammered. And so I see my role, for example, politically, where I'm focusing is getting people in the black community to see this is the same thing that happened to us. And to join that struggle around the undocumented immigrants and trying to get more and more people involved in that. But that's how I see it happening at the moment.
If I could just make one point on that.
Final remarks.
What's that? Yeah, which is that, I mean, I wanted to sharpen the contradiction which already emerged between the argument which two gentlemen on the panel agreed with, which is that workers and their immediate tenant political tendency tend to flow with the path of least resistance. On the other hand, that we, it seems like we also agree we need a socialist or a revolutionary movement and people to make up that movement, which are going, who are, I would add, going to have to devote themselves to long periods of work which are not going to be on the easy, whatever the, you know, the flowing, where, you know, in the easiest way. And the question then becomes, you know, how ought we as, you know, people trying to cultivate that kind of what I'll still call revolutionary or communist subjectivity in ourselves and others, you know, what does that mean for us in terms of how we understand the role that people's immediate, you know, interests, construed in however medium or short term, play in versus, let's say, something like, you know, the ethic of liberation, the ethic of commitment to other people, the ethic, I mean, what I hear, you know, in what the brother here was just saying was about the need to kind of get people to see in other people themselves, right? And not necessarily because it's going to hit them the next day, although in some struggles it may work that way, but because it's just fucking wrong what's going on, or because you've been there, or because you, it's something that you, you know, there's a connection there on some moral level. And I think that we need to, not neglect that aspect of what's here. And I think sometimes focusing on a certain kind of class approach to politics can make us hide that. I think a lot, you know, whenever I talk to a lot of people, even in social alternative and other groups, I ask, what is it that made you a revolutionary or a socialist? And occasionally it is like something that's very immediate economic. Generally it's like, I went to Mexico and I saw the way that the people have to
to live to survive, or you know, or the idea of bombs raining down, you know, on people just boggles my mind. And it seems to me that we shouldn't neglect that aspect, that moral aspect of if we're trying to think about building a true, you know, kind of sustainable, honest revolutionary movement. That would be my final remarks.
Okay, and I kind of wanted to, and this is probably not the fairest thing of me, because I want to kind of problematize a few things as the person with the last closing remark, so it's probably not fair, but I'm going to do it anyway. But first, I want to say, on the topic of revolutionary optimism, I was at the Oakland General Strike, because maybe it's a little problematic, it's more of a social strike because of how it occurred, but it's still, I think it's one of the most impressive days of struggle we've seen in a mass way in the U.S. in a while, one of the more impressive ones, and I wish I could share with everybody, and I don't know how to adequately describe it, the experience of, as if you're coming into the Port of Oakland, you come walk up a road, and so you're at the top of a hill, and you need to look down and see the absolute number of people there that were there shutting down the port, and how that felt. That was the first time I ever felt that we had a chance of winning, and at that moment, I felt like we will win, and anytime I get really, really depressed, I try to revisit in my memory that experience, and I wish I could share all that with you, because I think that, you know, the emotional aspect of having, you know, witnessing something that powerful is important. But I think there was a lot of talk about labor unions, and I feel like as someone, I'm not here for the IWW anyway, but as an IWW member, I kind of want to problematize this idea of, yes, there are a lot of workers in labor unions, but there's a lot more who aren't, that we can't just, we can't say organizing and struggling with bureaucracy and labor unions or whatever is a substitute for organizing around the point of production. That's really important, I think, to not stop at the current labor unions as they are, or even as we'd like them to be. And I also want to say that I'm not a fan of theories that there's that we need to take down and capitalism will go. I think that there are some critical links in capitalism in the U.S. Race is particularly important. I think the relationship between the overdeveloped world and the underdeveloped world, or the developing world, is particularly important globally. I think race in different areas looks very different. There's very different histories. In the U.S., we have our history. We've talked about that a lot. And I think another crucial thing that I wish I had gotten a chance to speak about more is I wish we talked more about reproductive labor, not in the sense of biological reproduction, but the reproduction of labor power. Of what does it take to get someone from the time they punch out one day to the time they punch in the next day? What is done? That often falls on women. The work of raising children often falls on women. And this stuff is really, it has been hidden too long, and I think a lot of work has been done to kind of reveal that and see that as a productive process that produces labor. And I think that we also, just the talk of who gets read and whose ideas are worth discussing, I think it's really important to look at conversations that occur and look at the movements people were in. I think it would be a mistake to look at the autonomous feminists in Italy without looking at the birth of the wages for housework movement there and the struggles of Italian feminists, and also to not look at C.L.R. James, who was a huge influence on the uprightismo and autonomia in Italy, and without looking at black feminists in the U.S. who were in dialogue with those Italian feminists and were huge important influences on them. So I think we should look always, when we look at a thinker, look at the struggles they were involved in, and look at who they read, who read them, and look at the conversation going on and the conversation between struggles, because struggles don't occur in isolation. We live in a global world.
Thank you very much to the panelists. Thanks.